Yesterday we talked a little bit about dogma, what it is, and I tried to say that dogma is not what I have to believe, but dogma really are the kind of markers that help the church to keep saying the word, or saying its word in such a way that the Christian experience continues to happen to people. When dogma becomes what I have to believe instead of what the church has to be saying, and I want to use the word saying here in a very broad and kind of not very precise sense. You speak in many ways besides using words verbally, but when I shift the notion of dogma from what the church has to be saying so that the Christian experience can happen to what people have to believe, it is at that point that Christianity simply becomes a set of doctrines that people can accept while they're watching the Bears and the Packers play football on Sunday afternoon, you know, and you interrupt them in the commercial and you say, "Do you believe in the divinity of Christ?" "Oh, yes, I do," you know. And it's part of our you know, intellectual freight that we take along, but it has nothing to do any longer with the Christian experience. The Christian experience, I think, is really contained in the words of Jesus to repent and believe the gospel. This is the way his proclamation was summed up. Yesterday we talked about original sin as one of the dogmas, and original sin is really the insight into human behavior, human existence, which lets us evaluate ourselves not in terms of repentance, you know, but in terms of defense, self-contrived defense. Today I want to talk about the second of the great dogmas, the divinity of Christ. And not much that we can do historically in the 25 or so minutes that are left to us. I just stole 5 minutes from you.
I may offer the divinity of Christ.
You may. Let me just say that I think it's important for us to kind of lump together the divinity of Christ and the dogma of the Trinity, because they're the same thing. Really having when the church formulated, capsuled its confession about Jesus in the statement at Chalcedon and the Creed of Nicaea, the dogma of the Trinity was pretty well decided. Now, what was going on here? There is, as I said before yesterday, no dogma of the Trinity in the New Testament. Nor is there a dogma of the divinity of Christ. In fact, if you look for any references in the New Testament which would say in so many words, Jesus of Nazareth was God, you're going to be hard put to find any like that. There are some that come quite close. The prologue to John's Gospel, which talks about the Word being with God and being God. Or Colossians, which talks about Jesus being the image of the invisible God. But or references to Jesus being the Son of God. But rarely anything more than that, and certainly nothing like the confession of Nicaea, that he is God of God, light from light, true God from true God, or the statement at Chalcedon in the year 451 A.D. that he is truly God and that he has two natures. Now, what happened, however, is that while the New Testament doesn't have any statements like this, it does have the gospel. And the dogmatic formulations of the church are designed to confess or to make possible the continued confession of the gospel in Jesus. Now, how did this happen? I'm going to give you the briefest conceivable historical sketches here, and then try to point out perhaps where some of the problems lay. The great Roman Catholic scholar at University of Toronto right now, Leslie Duarte or Dewart, I don't know how you pronounce it, feels that the whole movement of Christian thought into the Hellenistic culture of the Mediterranean world was a necessary movement if Christianity was to become a universal experience and not just be limited to, Jews who confessed in Jesus the Messiah. In order to make this move into the Hellenistic world, the Christian faith broke out of the Jewish thought world in which, St. Peter moved and generally also St. Paul, and began to try to formulate its faith, its proclamation in the thought patterns of the Hellenistic world. Now, this was both good and bad. I mean, it was necessary. The church had to do this. We're experiencing much the same thing today. Did we have a... Did she hurt herself? Okay. We're experiencing much the same thing today in the necessity to formulate the proclamation of the Christian gospel in, let's say, terms of our own culture, which isn't Hellenistic any longer. It isn't pre-technological. We have to try to formulate the Christian faith in a new culture, in our own culture. The same thing happens when our fellow Christians in India are trying to formulate in terms of Indian culture or Japanese culture. A couple of years ago here at Holden, we read together a marvelous book by a Japanese theologian, Kazuo Kitamori, called Theology of the Pain of God. And the book was billed as the first original Japanese theology. Since this is Far Eastern Day, it might not be bad to mention that. But this is a beautiful book, just a beautiful book, in which you see a man who's now a second-generation Christian. His parents also were Christians. Taking up an ancient Japanese concept, the pain of God, and making it the vehicle for the Christian proclamation. It was one of the most instructive experiences I've had. But the point is that the early apologies, second and third century now, began to take the Christian proclamation and translate it into the categories, the thought processes and patterns of the Hellenistic world. And it was in this situation that trial and error began to take place. The background for the proclamation that Jesus was God is the Greek notion, the Hellenistic notion, that God and the world have nothing to do with each other, that they are total and complete antitheses to each other. This is a long-standing element in Greek thought. God and the world are mutually exclusive opposites. God is pure spirit, and spirit was defined as the antithesis of matter. In this kind of a thought world, between God and material existence is a whole hierarchy of beings emanations of one sort or another, possessing material qualities in varying degrees. And the whole point of this Greek thought pattern was to provide a kind of key to origin. You know, how did the material world come into existence? If God is purely spiritual, or how does thought originate? Where do ideas come from? This is why you have this hierarchy of values. Arius, one of the presbyters of the Diocese of Alexandria, began to think of Jesus then in terms of one of these emanations, because this was a convenient thought pattern. The Christian, the opponents of Arius felt, however, that what was going to be lost in this whole way of thinking of Jesus as an emanation, something between the purely spiritual God and the purely material universe, that what would be lost in this process would be the Christian concern for salvation, for what Athanasius and many others perceived was that Christianity was not primarily about origin, where things came from, or the world came from, or where ideas came from, but Christianity was primarily about where salvation came from, or where it happened, how it happened, that it happened. For the Greeks, one should add, salvation, if it was thought of at all, was frequently thought of simply in terms of knowledge, of insight, of information. But for the Christian thinkers who opposed Arius, salvation was thought of in terms of a redemption of something which was fallen. Now, they felt that that in order to I want to add one other thing here, which is, I think, quite significant. In the process of using the Hellenistic categories, the categories of the Greek world, the Christian thinkers were critical of the very categories that they were using. I think this is the significant point that frequently is overlooked when we say, well, you know, they brought in all of this Hellenistic terminology about substance and nature and essence and personality into the doctrine of the Trinity, you know, and it gets very complicated. Why did they do all of this? I think one of the things that we must see is that they did all of this as a very sharp-minded criticism. They used the concepts of their culture, but they did not use them uncritically. And if we want to be confessors, you know, today, in the same sense in which these people were confessors in the 4th and 5th centuries, you know, we are going to be operating with the categories of our culture, but we're not going to, if we stand in the tradition of these confessors, we're not going to be taking over these categories uncritically. We're not going to, in short, get our signals from the culture around us. The culture is not the quarterback. The culture does not dominate the Christian community and its proclamation, or at least, if it is dominating, there's something pretty radically wrong, it seems to me. Jesus is dominus, you know. He dominates. The culture can be a vehicle. You know, this is why we have nothing to fear, it seems to me, from a secular culture. It's different, let's say, from a religious culture, different from the Hellenistic culture, but it is no worse a vehicle, you see, for Christian confession than any other culture. But I think the key here is that we must not let the secular culture dominate, be the dominus for our proclamation, but rather let Jesus Christ be the dominus, and the cultural forms are the vehicle. There was, however, in this whole process, one very significant problem for the Greeks. While they were critical of the culture, while they said, no, we're not going to think of Jesus as an emanation, because if we do, then our encounter with him is not yet an encounter with God, and what he does is not yet God's doing. Therefore, in order to preserve the doing of Jesus as God doing, in order to preserve the confession of that, it's going to be necessary for us to confess Jesus as God. And then they use the notion that he was of the same substance with the Father, and God of God, light of light, and so on. But in this process, they took over uncritically at this point a significant presupposition in the classical Greek or the Hellenistic Greek tradition, which caused endless problems, and in fact still causes problems today. And this is the assumption. I mean, they continued the assumption that God and man are ontological opposites. I'm sorry to have to use words like that, but let's see if we can make some sense out of them. This was not even said, you know, in so many words, as a kind of necessary presupposition. It was just kind of assumed that God, by his very being, was a qualitatively different kind of being than human being, and that the great distinction, or the great antinomy, let's say, the great antithesis between godly being and human being was to be found in the level of being. This assumption that the difference, the distinction, the antithesis between God and man was to be found at the level of being plagued the church endlessly, because there wasn't all that much of a conceptual problem involved in saying the logos, the word, the pre-existent Christ was God of God and light of light. The problem arose when theologians, fathers, confessors of the church, all of whom accepted without any question the confession at Nicaea that Jesus, or that Christ the Logos is God, when they came now to try to define how that God is incarnate in Jesus of Nazareth, you see, that is where the minds began to boggle and the problems began to emerge. See, the problems were there because they assumed that when you have divinity and humanity, you have two different kinds of being altogether. Now, how to think then of Jesus of Nazareth, the carpenter's son, as God? Well, one of the ways in which the theologians tried to think of it was formulated by Bishop Apollinarius of Laodicea in Asia Minor, now Turkey. Apollinarius hit on the happy notion that, after all, humanity was composed of bodies and soul. You know, the soul was the immaterial, the spiritual part of man. So let us just say that the humanity of Jesus consists of his body. The divinity of Jesus consists of his soul. This, for Apollinarius, explains several knotty problems. One, it explained how Jesus could know everything, they thought he did, since the soul was the equivalent of the mind. The immaterial part of you was your consciousness. It also explained how Jesus could die without God dying, since God, they said, by definition, you see, this was their assumption, God is immortal, incapable of death. Because when Jesus died on the cross, only the body died. A good old Greek notion here. The soul, the mind, the consciousness didn't die on the resurrection. You know, you just have the soul coming back to the body, and boy, everything's all done. But somebody said, hey, wait a minute. That's not very good theology either, because if he didn't take on a human mind and a human soul, you know, then he wasn't really man. So they kicked poor Apollinarius out of the church and did all sorts of terrible things to him, you know. So one bad thing. The guys who have the most orthodox theology and, you know, who are generally pretty right in their insights are also the nastiest birds in the ancient church, too. Somehow or other, you almost have to pray to be delivered from orthodoxy lest you turn out to be like them. Sad that we have these painful choices. That's why it's necessary for Carroll to say, what is his quotation, that the business of being right is always wrong. Which doesn't mean, you know, that we should try to be wrong so that we can avoid... Yeah, all right. It gets pretty complicated at this hour of the morning. Let's get back to something simple like the divinity of Christ. Well... The next attempted solution at this problem, and the interesting thing now is that most of these problems centered around whether Jesus could die. The two great problems for the Greeks were the birth and the death of Jesus. You know, they didn't have any choice. The Greeks could think of gods, you know, cavorting around in the hayfields with maidens, imitating men. I mean, you know, you could man for a day, right? I mean, they could conceive of that, right? And then there were all these little, you know, in Greek mythology, all these little illegitimate half-god, half-men children. But the birth and the death, you know, these were the... How do you conceive of God being born and dying? Nestorius, who was the Archbishop of Constantinople, and really one of the most, he was a nice guy. That was his problem. You know, he didn't fight like the Cyril of Alexandria was a first-rate schnook. But he was right. You know, that's the problem. Well, Nestorius's idea was that you had kind of like two separate people. Being, you had the Logos, right? The Word, the Eternal Word, who was God, with all the qualities and attributes of God. And then you had Jesus of Nazareth, the man. And these two exist side by side in a being that Nestorius called the Christ. And he was willing to say that Christ was born, but not God was born. He was willing to say Christ died, but not God died. Well, he was, I think, rightly accused at this point of saying, oh, you've got three things going here, you know, not just two. You've got God, you've got man, and then you have a third thing. So Cyril finally got him kicked out, and all sorts of things. They used to do terrible things, even after a guy died, you know. If they discovered he was wrong while he was alive, they would dig up his bones and burn them and scatter the ashes and gather all his books and burn them. Poor, you know, no rest for the dead, even. But what to do? The whole thing hinged on the confession that Mary was the mother of God, you see? For to confess that Mary was the mother of God was kind of for these people the key. Cyril finally won, and at Chalcedon in 451, the church formulated the famous definition of Chalcedon, that Jesus the Christ had two natures, divine and human, in one person. And that these natures were not to be mixed or confused, nor separated and divided. Well, that was really no solution. It was only a statement of the problem. And the reason why it was only a statement of the problem was because the confession carried with it all of the freight of the Greek presuppositions that God and man were different kinds of being altogether. That is, they were not just different, they were mutually exclusive. You know, it would be like saying, you know, that her brokering is a man and a tree at the same time. You know, you've got two different kinds of being here, one that can walk around and the other that can't. Well, why is this a statement of the problem? It's, again, a statement of the problem. Not because there is a problem inherent in the confession of Jesus as God and man, but because there are assumptions about God. Let me get at it in another way. When I was a kid, we had a little catechism in the Missouri Synod with about 190 pages of questions and answers that were designed to make true Christians and Orthodox believers out of all of us. And everybody who didn't have the true catechism just didn't make it. Well, in this catechism, when it got to the questions about Jesus, they would say, how do we know that Jesus is true God? Then would come the answer. Because he has divine names, because he has divine works ascribed to him, and because he has divine honor and glory. And how do we know that Jesus is true man? Well, because he has human names, human characteristics ascribed to him, you know. But what is the assumption here? Isn't the assumption that we know what divine names are? Huh? We know what divine works are. We know what divine honor and glory is. Well, that's assuming an awful lot, you know. When there's a baseball player named Jesus Alou, you know, it begins to be a little difficult to decide who's got divine names finally, huh? What is a divine name, you know? Would God be God if we called him Boogaloo or something like that? Well, of course he would. I mean, what is a divine name? You know, what is a divine work finally? Who can say that lighting a fire is a human work, but lightning is a divine work, you know. I mean, on what basis does one even make those kinds of distinctions, you see? Who was somebody we were talking to here one of these days had some new veins put in around his heart. See, who can say that is a human work? You know, but to create a heart in the first place is a divine work. I mean, how can you make those distinctions? Right? Or that let's say to heal a schizophrenic is a human work because, you know, any old psychiatrist can do it, right? But to heal a leper, like in the New Testament, is a divine work. How can we make those kinds of distinctions? Now, what happens then when we start thinking, you see, of God and man, or divine and human, as the key antinomies, as the key opposites, as mutually exclusive beings? When we think in these terms, then we're going to have a host of problems. Let me just articulate some that happen to church people all the time. One is that we say, this is a stupid doctrine. And you know, we're just going to quit saying Jesus of Nazareth was a man, that's all he was, you know, great teacher, founder of a religion. There are a lot of people, you know, who finally just slide off the horse on that side. On the other side, you know, are those of us who think of Jesus in completely unhuman terms, inhuman, non-human. That's what happens most of the time. You know. the temptations of Jesus. How could he resist the devil? Well, of course he could. He was God, we say, you see. Or how could he do the things he did? Well, of course he could. You see, he was God. We immediately leap to the kind of God solution to every last challenging aspect of Jesus' activity. Still others of us say, well, you know, I mean, these are the people who slide off the saddle, so to speak, on the other side. Still others, you know, try to hold these two in tension the way Calcedon did. And then we end up with a kind of shut up and believe theology. You know, this is authoritarianism in religion. And this leads to a kind of irrational Christianity. You know, you aren't supposed to understand. These are the great mysteries of the faith, you see. That Jesus is God and man, you aren't supposed to understand that. It's a great mystery. Just shut up and believe it. In the ancient church, in the eastern half of the empire, orthodoxy was enforced by the emperor's troops. Right? Wherever they could collect taxes, they could enforce the Chalcedonian Confession. And wherever they didn't collect taxes, there you had a whole bunch of Eastern, I hate to use the word heresies at this point, but let's say non-Chalcedonian Christianities developing, like the Coptic Church or the Martoma Church, many of these Eastern Rite churches that are not today Orthodox. They all arose wherever the emperor couldn't send his troops, you see. So that authority, military authority, became the basis for enforcing Chalcedonian Orthodoxy in the eastern half of the empire. In the western half, the Western Church spent the next 1,000 years arguing over authority, not theology, but authority, you see. For the crucial issue was the authority of the church. The authority of the church to define dogma, the authority of the church to appoint bishops, and to run the show. The conflict between pope and secular rulers was the dominant theme for the next 1,000 years. And wherever you had the popes enforcing their authority, again, you had shut up and believe Christianity. In fact, it was shut up or be burned. That's really what it was all about. When the Reformation came along and papal authority disappeared, you have a breakup, once again, of the confession of the divinity of Christ. You have Unitarian concepts arising already in the Reformation era. The Socinians, Michael Servetus, this very tragic man who was burned in Geneva, because as he died, he shouted, Jesus, Son of the Eternal God. And somebody said if he'd been willing to shift the adjective, he would not have been burned. If he'd have said Jesus, Eternal Son of God, instead of Son of the Eternal God. So, you see, now, how to get out of this? My basic assumption is that the church's instinct in confessing Jesus as God was a good one, a valid one, and a necessary one, for the sake of the gospel. But if this is going to make sense, we've got to undercut the assumption that God and man are opposite beings. For it seems to me that the crucial antinomy in our experience, in life itself, is not so much that God and man are different beings. For it isn't man as man who is the antithesis of God, but man as fallen man, fallen in the sense in which we talked about it yesterday, man as self-vindicating man. And in the act of vindicating himself, you see, refusing to entrust himself to God. That is the crucial antinomy. Now, what happens then, you see, is that self-vindicating man meets defeat for his self-vindication at every encounter with God in the world in which we live. To meet God in the processes of history, or in space, or in nature, you know, is to meet God who eventually defeats all of our attempts at vindicating, defending, justifying, affirming ourselves. Our moralities are defeated by our hypocrisies. Our empires are defeated by their overthrow. We cannot build the Tower of Babel on this continent or anywhere else. We can't build a secure civilization, secure against the ravages of our own pretensions. We cannot build secure lives. All of our attempts meet defeat. The God that we meet in the processes of this world is not, you know, a God who is our opposite in being, but who is the enemy of our pretension and of our pride and of our desperate, urgent, self-vindicating, self-justifying activity. To confess then that Jesus is God, you see, is not to confess an ontological absurdity or an ontological miracle or an ontological mystery, you see, that here two opposite beings coincide, but rather to confess Jesus as God is to confess the miracle of grace, the miracle of God's love. For when the church confesses that Jesus is God, you see, it is not trying to say something about beings. It is trying to say something about God coming to terms with human pretension and human self-vindication in another way, a different way, than he meets it in the judgment that takes place in nature and history and space and time. You see, how does God meet and deal with and confront our fallen humanity, our self-vindicating humanity in Jesus of Nazareth? Why, he does it by committing himself to us. Not by being the God of death, as I even forget that man's name, wrote a gorgeous article in the Christian Century called Death of God or God of Death. And, you know, that's right. I mean, where do we meet ultimacy, that which is absolutely beyond our control? Well, two places are birth and death. That is where we have no control. We didn't choose to be born. We do not choose to die. It happens to us willy-nilly. All right. So God may be the God of death, but in Jesus of Nazareth, we have the death of God. And that's what the Christian community is trying to confess. And so, you know, we don't begin with the assumption that God cannot die. For in Jesus of Nazareth, the grace of God happens in the death of God. That is his commitment to us. The parable of the prodigal son, says Norman Perrin, stands at the center of Jesus' own definition of his function and purpose and ministry. He is the father in the parable of the prodigal son. He was accused of eating with sinners. And so he tells these three great stories about himself. The story in which he is the shepherd, and in which he is the woman, and in which he is the father. If we think that it does not cost the father, in the prodigal of the parable son, to be the forgiver, then we have missed the point. Jesus is the cost. Jesus is what it costs God to forgive sins, in a famous Harry Emerson Fosdick sermon. And so his death is at the heart of what it means when we confess that Jesus is God. For the great antinomies are not, God as God versus man as man, but holy God versus the self-vindicating unbelief of man. Jesus gives us an alternative to self-vindication. He becomes our vindicator. He gives us an alternative to self-justification. He becomes our justifier. He gives us an alternative to self-affirmation, that is, self-contrived, illusory self-affirmation. He affirms us and says, we don't need the phony defenses and justifications and vindications that we erect. And in doing so, he summons us to trust him. That's why he affirms sinners and eats with them and lifts us now to the level of true humanity by setting us free. Well, Herb, you didn't stop. It's 20 after.
Well, I would want to update the divinity of Christ.
All right.